I do not redden in sunlight. Instead, my skin becomes progressively dark. The sun singes the flesh. When I was a boy, the white summer sun of Sacramento would darken me so, my T-shirt would seem bleached against my slender dark arms. My mother would see me come up the front steps. She'd wait for the screen door to slam at my back. "You look like a negrito," she'd say, angry. Sorry to be angry, frustrated almost to laughing scorn. You know how important looks are in this country? With los gringos, looks are all that they judge on. But you, look at you, you're so careless. Then she'd start in all over again. You won't be satisfied till you end up looking like los pobres who work in the fields, los braceros. Los braceros. Those men who work with their brazos, their arms. Mexican nationals who were licensed to work for American farmers in the 1950s. They worked very hard for very little money, my father would tell me. And what money they earned, they sent back to Mexico to support their families, my mother would add. Los pobres, the poor, the pitiful, the powerless ones, but paradoxically also powerful men. They were the men with brown, muscled arms I stared at in awe on Saturday mornings when they showed up downtown like gypsies to shop at Woolworth's or Penny's. On Monday nights, they would gather hours early on the steps of the Memorial Auditorium for the wrestling matches. Passing by on my bicycle in summer, I would spy them there, clustered in small groups, talking, frightening and fascinating men, some wearing Texas sombreros and T-shirts which shone fluorescent in the twilight. I would sit forward in the back seat of our family's 48 Chevy to see them, working alongside valley highways. Dark men on an even horizon, loading a truck amid rows of straight green. Powerful, powerless men. Their fascinating darkness, like mine, to be feared.
You'll end up looking just like them.
1. Regarding my family, I see faces that do not closely resemble my own. Like some other Mexican families, my family suggests Mexico's confused colonial past. Gathered around a table, we appear to be from separate continents. My father's face recalls faces I have seen in France. His complexion is white. He does not tan. He does not burn. Over the years, his dark wavy hair has grayed handsomely. But with time, his face has sagged to a perpetual sigh. My mother, whose surname is inexplicably Irish, Moran, has an olive complexion. People have frequently wondered if perhaps she is Italian or Portuguese, and in fact she looks as though she could be from Southern Europe. My mother's face has not aged as quickly as the rest of her body. It remains smooth and glowing, a cool tan, which her gray hair cleanly accentuates. My older brother has inherited her good looks. When he was a boy, people would tell him that he looked like Mario Lanza, and hearing it, he would smile with dimpled assurance. He would come home from high school with girlfriends who seemed to me glamorous because they were blondes. And during those years, I envied him his skin that burned red and peeled like the skin of the gringos. His complexion never darkened like mine. My youngest sister is exotically pale, almost ashen. She is delicately featured. Near Eastern, people have said. Only my older sister has a complexion as dark as mine, though her facial features are much less harshly defined than my own. To many people meeting her, she seems, they say, Polynesian. I am the only one in the family whose face is severely cut to the line of ancient Indian ancestors. My face is mournfully long in the classical Indian manner. My profile suggests one of those beak-nosed Mayan sculptures. The eagle-like face upturned, open-mouthed against the deserted primitive sky. We are Mexicans, my mother and father would say, and taught their four children to say whatever we often were asked about our ancestry. My mother and father scorned those white Mexican-Americans who tried to pass themselves off as Spanish. My parents would never have thought of denying their ancestry. I never denied it. My ancestry is Mexican. I told strangers mechanically, but I never forgot that only my older sister's complexion was as dark as mine. My older sister never spoke to me about her complexion when she was a girl. But I guess that she found her dark skin a burden. I knew that she suffered for being a nigger. As she came home from grammar school, little boys came up behind her and pushed her down to the sidewalk. In high school, she struggled in the adolescent competition for boyfriends in a world of football games and proms, a world where her looks were plainly uncommon. In college, she was afraid and scornful when dark-skinned foreign students from countries like Turkey and India found her attractive. She revealed her fear of dark skin to me only in adulthood, when, regarding her own three children, she quietly admitted relief that they were all light. That is the kind of remark women in my family have often made before. As a boy, I'd stay in the kitchen, never seeming to attract any notice, listening while my aunts spoke of their pleasure at having light children. The men, some of whom were dark-skinned from years of working out of doors, would be in another part of the house. It was the woman's spoken concern, the fear of having a dark-skinned son or daughter. Remedies were exchanged. One aunt prescribed to her sisters the elixir of large doses of castor oil during the last weeks of pregnancy. The remedy risked an abortion. Children born dark grew up to have their faces treated regularly with a mixture of egg white and lemon juice concentrate. In my case, the solution never would take. One Mexican-American friend of my mother's, who regarded it a special blessing that she had a measure of English blood, spoke disparagingly of her husband, a construction worker, for being so dark. "He doesn't take care of himself," she complained. But the remark, I noticed, annoyed my mother, who sat tracing an invisible design with her finger on the tablecloth. There was affection, too, and a kind of humor about these matters. With daring tenderness, one of my uncles would refer to his wife as mi negra. An aunt regularly called her dark child mi feito, my little ugly one, her smile only partially hidden as she bent down to dig her mouth under his ticklish chin. And at times, relatives spoke scornfully of pale white skin. A gringo skin resembled masa, baker's dough, someone remarked. Everyone laughed. Voices chuckled over the fact that the gringos spent so many hours in summer sunning themselves. "They need to get sun because they look like los muertos." I heard the laughing but remembered what the women had said with unsmiling voices concerning dark skin. Nothing I heard outside the house regarding my skin was so impressive to me. In public, I occasionally heard racial slurs. Complete strangers would yell out at me. A teenager drove past shouting, "Hey, greaser, hey, Pancho." Over his shoulder, I saw the giggling face of his girlfriend. A boy pedaled by and announced matter-of-factly, "I pee on dirty Mexicans." Such remarks would be said so casually that I wouldn't quickly realize that they were being addressed to me. When I did, I would be paralyzed with embarrassment, unable to return the insult. Those times I happened to be with white grammar school friends, they shouted back. Imbued with the mysterious kindness of children, my friends would never ask later why I hadn't yelled out in my own defense. In all, there could not have been more than a dozen incidents of name-calling. That there were so few suggests that I was not a primary victim of racial abuse, but that, even today, I can clearly remember particular incidents as proof of their impact. Because of such incidents, I listened when my parents remarked that Mexicans were often mistreated in California border towns, and in Texas. I listened carefully when I heard that two of my cousins had been refused admittance to an all-white swimming pool, and that an uncle had been told by some man to go back to Africa. I followed the progress of the Southern Black Civil Rights Movement, which was gaining prominent notice in Sacramento's afternoon newspaper. But what most intrigued me was the connection between dark skin and poverty. Because I heard my mother speak so often about the relegation of dark people to menial labor, I considered the great victims of racism to be those who were poor and forced to do menial work. People like the farm workers whose skin was dark from the sun. After meeting a black grammar school friend of my sister's, I remember thinking that she wasn't really black. What interested me was the fact that she wasn't poor. Her well-dressed parents would come by after work to pick her up in a shiny green Oldsmobile. By contrast, the garbage men who appeared every Friday morning seemed to me unmistakably black. I didn't bother to ask my parents why Sacramento garbage men always were black. I thought I knew. One morning I was in the backyard when a man opened the gate. He was an ugly, square-faced black man with popping red eyes, a pail slung over his shoulder. As he approached, I stood up, and in a voice that seemed to me very weak, I piped, "Hi." But the man paid me no heed. He strode past to the can by the garage. In a single broad movement, he overturned its contents into his larger pail. Our can came crashing down as he turned and left me watching in awe. "Pobres negros," my mother remarked when she'd noticed a headline in the paper about a civil rights demonstration in the South. "How the gringos mistreat them." In the same tone of voice, she'd tell me about the mistreatment her brother endured years before. After my grandfather's death, my grandmother had come to America with her son and five daughters. My sisters, we were still all just teenagers. And since mi papa was dead, my brother had to be the head of the family. He had to support us, to find work. But what skills did he have? 20 years old. Pobre. He was tall, like your grandfather, and strong. He did construction work. Construction. The gringos kept him digging all day, doing the dirtiest jobs. And they would pay him next to nothing. Sometimes they promised him one salary and paid him less when he finished. But what could he do? Report them? We weren't citizens then. He didn't even know English. And he was dark. What chances could he have? As soon as we sisters got older, he went right back to Mexico. He hated this country. He looked so tired when he left. Already with a hunchback, still in his 20s, but old-looking. No life for him here. Pobre. Dark skin was for my mother the most important symbol of a life of oppressive labor and poverty. But both my parents recognized other symbols as well. My father noticed the feel of every hand he shook. He'd smile sometimes, marvel more than scorn, remembering a man he'd met who had soft, uncalloused hands. My mother would grab a towel in the kitchen and rub my oily face sore when I came in from playing outside. "Clean the grass off of your face, greaser." Symbols. When my older sister, then in high school, asked my mother if she could do light housework in the afternoons for a rich lady we knew, my mother was frightened by the idea. For several weeks she troubled over it before granting conditional permission. "Just remember, you're not a maid. I don't want you wearing a uniform." My father echoed the same warning. Walking with him past a hotel, I watched as he stared at a doorman dressed like a beefeater. How can anyone let himself be dressed up like that? Like a clown. "Don't you ever get a job where you have to put on a uniform." In summertime, neighbors would ask me if I wanted to earn extra money by mowing their lawns. Again and again, my mother worried. "Why did they ask you? Can't you find anything better?" Inevitably, she'd relent. She knew I needed the money, but I was instructed to work after dinner, when the sun's not so hot. Even then, I'd have to wear a hat. Un sombrero de baseball. Sombrero. Watching gray cowboy movies, I'd brood over the meaning of the broad-rimmed hat, that troubling symbol which comically distinguished a Mexican cowboy from real cowboys. From my father came no warnings concerning the sun. His fear was of dark factory jobs. He remembered too well his first jobs when he came to this country, not intending to stay, just to earn money enough to sail on to Australia. In Mexico, he had heard too many stories of discrimination in Los Estados Unidos. So it was Australia, that distant island continent, that loomed in his imagination as his America. The work my father found in San Francisco was work for the unskilled, a factory job, then a cannery job. He'd remember the noise and the heat. Then a job at a warehouse. He'd remember the dark stench of old urine. At one place, there were fistfights. At another, a supervisor who hated Chinese and Mexicans. Nowhere a union. His memory of himself in those years is held by those jobs, never making money enough for passage to Australia. Slowly giving up the plan of returning to school to resume his third-grade education, to become an engineer. My memory of him in those years, however, is lifted from photographs in the family album, which show him on his honeymoon with my mother, the woman who had convinced him to stay in America. I have studied their photographs often, seeking to find in those figures some clear resemblance to the man and the woman I've known as my parents. But the youthful faces in the photos remain, behind dark glasses, shadowy figures anticipating my mother and father. They are pictured on the grounds of the Coronado Hotel near San Diego, standing in the pale light of a winter afternoon. She is wearing slacks. Her hair falls seductively over one side of her face. He appears wearing a double-breasted suit, an unneeded raincoat draped over his arm. Another shows them standing together, solemnly staring ahead. Their shoulders barely are touching. There is to their pose an aristocratic formality, an elegant Latin hauteur. The man in those pictures is the same man who is fascinated by Italian grand opera. I have never known just what my father saw in the spectacle, but he has told me that he would take my mother to the opera house every Friday night, if he had money enough for orchestra seats. Why go to sit in the balcony? On Sundays, he'd don Italian silk scarves and a camel's hair coat to take his new wife to the polo matches in Golden Gate Park. But one weekend, my father stopped going to the opera and polo matches. He would blame the change in his life on one job, a warehouse job, working for a large corporation which today advertises its products with the smiling faces of children. "They made me an old man before my time," he'd say to me many years later. Afterward, jobs got easier and cleaner. Eventually, in middle age, he got a job making false teeth. But his youth was spent at the warehouse. Everything changed, his wife remembers. The dapper young man in the old photographs yielded to the man I saw after dinner, haggard, asleep on the sofa. During the Ed Sullivan show on Sunday nights, when Roberta Peters or Licia Albanese would appear on the tiny blue screen, his head would jerk up alert. He'd sit forward while the notes of Puccini sounded before him. Un bel dì. By the time they had a family, my parents no longer dressed in very fine clothes. Those symbols of great wealth and the reality of their lives too noisily clashed. No longer did they try to fit themselves, like paper doll figures, behind trappings so foreign to their actual lives. My father no longer wore silk scarves or expensive wool suits. He sold his tuxedo to a second-hand store for $5. My mother sold her rabbit fur coat to the wife of a Spanish radio station disc jockey. "It looks better on you than it does on me," she kept telling the lady until the sale was completed. I was 6 years old at the time, but I recall watching the transaction with complete understanding. The woman I knew as my mother was already physically unlike the woman in her honeymoon photos. My mother's hair was short. Her shoulders were thick from carrying children. Her fingers were swollen red, toughened by house cleaning. Already my mother would admit to foreseeing herself in her own mother, a woman grown old, bald and bow-legged after a hard lifetime of working. In their manner, both my parents continued to respect the symbols of what they considered to be upper-class life. Very early they taught me the propia way of eating como los ricos, and I was carefully taught elaborate formulas of polite greeting and parting. The dark little boy would be invited by classmates to the rich houses on 44th and 45th Streets. "How do you do?" or "I am very pleased to meet you," I would say, bowing slightly to the amused mothers of classmates. "Thank you very much for the dinner. It was very delicious." I made an impression. I intended to make an impression, to be invited back. I soon realized that the trick was to get the mother or father to notice me. From those early days began an association with rich people, my fascination with their secret. My mother worried. She warned me not to come home expecting to have the things my friends possessed. But she needn't have said anything. When I went to the big houses, I remembered that I was, at best, a visitor to the world I saw there. For that reason, I was an especially watchful guest. I was my parents' child. Things most middle-class children wouldn't trouble to notice, I studied. remembered to see. The starched black and white uniform worn by the maid who opened the door. The Mexican gardeners, their complexions as dark as my own. One gardener's face, glassed by sweat, looked up to see me going inside. "Take Richard upstairs and show him your electric train," the mother said. But it was really the vast polished dining room table I'd come to appraise. Those nights, when I was invited to stay for dinner, I'd noticed that my friend's mother rang a small silver bell to tell the black woman when to bring in the food. The father, at his end of the table, ate while wearing his tie. When I was not required to speak, I'd skate the icy cut of crystal with my eye. My gaze would follow the golden threads etched onto the rim of china. With my mother's eyes, I'd see my hostess's manicured nails and judge them to be marks of her leisure. Later, when my schoolmate's father would bid me good night, I would feel his soft fingers and palm when we shook hands. And turning to leave, I'd see my dark self lit by chandelier light in a tall hallway mirror. 2. Complexion. My first conscious experience of sexual excitement concerns my complexion. One summer weekend, when I was around 7 years old, I was at a public swimming pool with the whole family. I remember sitting on the damp pavement next to the pool and seeing my mother in the spectators' bleachers, holding my younger sister on her lap. My mother, I noticed, was watching my father as he stood on a diving board, waving to her. I watched her wave back, then saw her radiant, bashful, astonishing smile. In that second, I sensed that my mother and father had a relationship I knew nothing about. A nervous excitement encircled my stomach as I saw my mother's eyes follow my father's figure curving into the water. A second or two later, he emerged. I heard him call out. Smiling, his voice sounded buoyant, calling me to swim to him. But turning to see him, I caught my mother's eye. I heard her shout over to me. In Spanish, she called through the crowd, "Put a towel on over your shoulders." In public, she didn't want to say why. I knew. That incident anticipates the shame and sexual inferiority I was to feel in later years because of my dark complexion. I was to grow up an ugly child, or one who thought himself ugly, fail. One night when I was 11 or 12 years old, I locked myself in the bathroom and carefully regarded my reflection in the mirror over the sink. Without any pleasure, I studied my skin. I turned on the faucet. In my mind, I heard the swirling voices of aunts and even my mother's voice whispering incessantly about lemon juice solutions and dark, failed children. With a bar of soap, I fashioned a thick ball of lather. I began soaping my arms. I took my father's straight razor out of the medicine cabinet. Slowly, with steady deliberateness, I put the blade against my flesh, pressed it as close as I could without cutting, and moved it up and down across my skin to see if I could get out, somehow lessen the dark. All I succeeded in doing, however, was in shaving my arms bare of their hair. For as I noted with disappointment, the dark would not come out. It remained trapped, deep in the cells of my skin. Throughout adolescence, I felt myself mysteriously marked. Nothing else about my appearance would concern me so much as the fact that my complexion was dark. My mother would say how sorry she was that there was not money enough to get braces to straighten my teeth. But I never bothered about my teeth. In three-way mirrors at department stores, I'd see my profile dramatically defined by a long nose, but it was really only the color of my skin that caught my attention. I wasn't afraid that I would become a menial laborer because of my skin, nor did my complexion make me feel especially vulnerable to racial abuse. I didn't really consider my dark skin to be a racial characteristic. I would have been only too happy to look as Mexican as my light-skinned older brother. Simply, I judged myself ugly. And since the women in my family had been the ones who discussed it in such worried tones, I felt my dark skin made me unattractive to women. 13 years old. 14. In a grammar school art class, when the assignment was to draw a self-portrait, I tried and I tried, but could not bring myself to shade in the face on the paper to anything like my actual tone. With disgust, then, I would come face to face with myself in mirrors. With disappointment, I located myself in class photographs, my dark face undefined by the camera, which had clearly described the white faces of classmates, where I'd see my dark wrist against my long-sleeved white shirt. I grew divorced from my body, insecure, overweight, listless. On hot summer days, when my rubber-soled shoes soaked up the heat from the sidewalk, I kept my head down, or walked in the shade. My mother didn't need any more to tell me to watch out for the sun. I denied myself a sensational life. The normal, extraordinary, animal excitement of feeling my body alive, riding shirtless on a bicycle in the warm wind created by furious self-propelled motion, the sensations that first had excited in me a sense of my maleness, I denied. I was too ashamed of my body. I wanted to forget that I had a body because I had a brown body. I was grateful that none of my classmates ever mentioned the fact. I continued to see the braceros. Those men I resembled in one way and, in another way, didn't resemble at all. On the watery horizon of a valley afternoon, I'd see them. And though I feared looking like them, it was with silent envy that I regarded them still. I envied them their physical lives, their freedom to violate the taboo of the sun. Closer to home, I would notice the shirtless construction workers, the roofers, the sweating men tarring the street in front of the house. And I'd see the Mexican gardeners. I was unwilling to admit the attraction of their lives. I tried to deny it by looking away. But what was denied became strongly desired. In high school physical education classes, I withdrew in the regular company of five or six classmates to a distant corner of a football field where we smoked and talked. Our company was composed of bodies too short or too tall, all graceless and all, except mine, pale. Our conversation was usually witty. In fact, we were intelligent. If we referred to the athletic contests around us, it was with sarcasm. With savage scorn, I'd refer to the animals playing football or baseball. It would have been important for me to have joined them, or for me to have taken off my shirt, to have let the sun burn dark on my skin, and to have run barefoot on the warm, wet grass. It would have been very important. Too important. It would have been too telling a gesture to admit the desire for sensation, the body, my body. 15, 16. I was a teenager shy in the presence of girls, never dated, barely could talk to a girl without stammering. In high school, I went to several dances, but I never managed to ask a girl to dance, so I stopped going. I cannot remember high school years now with the parade of typical images, bright drive-ins or gliding blue shadows of a junior prom. At home, most weekend nights, I would pass evenings reading. Like those hidden, precocious adolescents who have no real-life sexual experiences, I read a great deal of romantic fiction. "You won't find it in your books," my brother would playfully taunt me as he prepared to go to a party by freezing the crest of the wave in his hair with sticky pomade. Through my reading, however, I developed a fabulous and sophisticated sexual imagination. At 17, I may not have known how to engage a girl in small talk, but I had read Lady Chatterley's Lover. It annoyed me to hear my father's teasing, that I would never know what real work is, that my hands were so soft. I think I knew it was his way of admitting pleasure and pride in my academic success, but I didn't smile. My mother said she was glad their children were getting their educations and would not be pushed around like los pobres. I heard the remark ironically as a reminder of my separation from los braceros. At such times, I suspected that education was making me effeminate. The odd thing, however, was that I did not judge my classmates so harshly, nor did I consider my male teachers in high school effeminate. It was only myself I judged against some shadowy, mythical Mexican laborer, dark like me, yet very different. Language was crucial. I knew that I had violated the ideal of the macho, by becoming such a dedicated student of language and literature. Machismo was a word never exactly defined by the persons who used it. It was best described in the proper behavior of men. Women at home, nevertheless, would repeat the old Mexican dictum that a man should be feo, fuerte, y formal. The three F's, my mother called them, smiling slyly. Feo I took to mean not literally ugly, so much as ruggedly handsome. When my mother and her sister spent a loud laughing afternoon determining ideal male good looks, they finally settled on the actor Gilbert Roland, who was neither too pretty nor ugly, but had looks like a man. Fuerte, strong, seemed to mean not physical strength as much as inner strength, character.
A dependable man is fuerte.
Fuerte, for that reason, was a characteristic subsumed by the last of the three qualities, and the one I most often considered, formal. To be formal is to be steady, a man of responsibility, a good provider. Someone formal is also constant. A person to be relied upon in adversity. A sober man, a man of high seriousness. I learned a great deal about being formal just by listening to the way my father and other male relatives of his generation spoke. A man was not silent necessarily, nor was he limited in the tones he could sound. For example, he could tell a long, involved, humorous story and laugh at his own humor with high-pitched giggling. But a man was not talkative the way a woman could be. It was permitted a woman to be gossipy and chatty. When one heard many voices in a room, it was usually women who were talking. Men spoke much less rapidly, and often men spoke in monologues. When one voice sounded in a crowded room, it was most often a man's voice one heard. More important than any of this was the fact that a man never verbally revealed his emotions. Men did not speak about their unease in moments of crisis or danger. It was the woman who worried aloud when her husband got laid off from work. At time of illness or death in the family, a man was usually quiet, even silent. Women spoke up to voice prayers. In distress, women always sounded quick ejaculations to God or the Virgin. Women prayed in clearly audible voices at a wake held in a funeral parlor. And on the subject of love, a woman was verbally expansive. She spoke of her yearning and delight. A married man, if he spoke publicly about love, usually did so with playful, mischievous irony. Younger, unmarried men more often were quiet. The macho is a silent suitor. Formal. At home, I was quiet, so perhaps I seemed formal to my relations and other Spanish-speaking visitors to the house. But outside the house, my God, I talked. Particularly in class or alone with my teachers, I chattered. Talking seemed to make teachers think I was bright. I often was proud of my way with words. Though on other occasions, for example, when I would hear my mother busily speaking to women, it would occur to me that my attachment to words made me like her, her son, not formal like my father. At such times, I even suspected that my nostalgia for sounds, the noisy, intimate Spanish sounds of my past, was nothing more than effeminate yearning. High school English teachers encouraged me to describe very personal feelings in words. Poems and short stories I wrote, expressing sorrow and loneliness, were awarded high grades. In my bedroom were books by poets and novelists, books that I loved, in which male writers published feelings the men in my family never revealed or acknowledged in words. And it seemed to me that there was something unmanly about my attachment to literature. Even today, when so much about the myth of the macho no longer concerns me, I cannot altogether evade such notions. Writing these pages, admitting my embarrassment or my guilt, admitting my sexual anxieties and my physical insecurity, I have not been able to forget that I am not being formal. So be it. 3. I went to college at Stanford, attracted partly by its academic reputation, partly because it was the school rich people went to. I found myself on a campus with golden children of Western America's upper middle class. Many were students both ambitious for academic success and accustomed to leisured life in the sun. In the afternoon, they lay spread out, sunbathing in front of the library, reading Swift or Engels or Beckett. Others went by in convertibles, off to play tennis or ride horses or sail. Beach boys dressed in tank tops and shorts were my classmates in undergraduate seminars. Tall tan girls wearing white strapless dresses sat directly in front of me in lecture rooms. I'd study them, their physical confidence. I was still recognizably kin to the boy I had been, less tortured perhaps, but still kin. At Stanford, it's true, I began to have something like a conventional sexual life. I don't think, however, that I really believed that the women I knew found me physically appealing. I continued to stay out of the sun. I didn't linger in mirrors, and I was the student at Stanford who remembered to notice the Mexican-American janitors and gardeners working on campus. It was at Stanford one day, near the end of my senior year, that a friend told me about a summer construction job he knew was available. I was quickly alert. Desire uncoiled within me. My friend said that he knew I had been looking for summer employment. He knew I needed some money. Almost apologetically, he explained, it was something I probably wouldn't be interested in, but a friend of his, a contractor, needed someone for the summer to do menial jobs. There would be lots of shoveling and raking and sweeping. Nothing too hard, but nothing more interesting either. Still, the pay would be good. Did I want it, or did I know someone who did? I did. Yes, I said, surprised to hear myself say it. In the weeks following, friends cautioned that I had no idea how hard physical labor really is. You only think you know what it is like to shovel for 8 hours straight. Their objections seemed to me challenges. They resolved the issue. I became happy with my plan. I decided, however, not to tell my parents. I wouldn't tell my mother because I could guess her worried reaction. I would tell my father only after the summer was over, when I could announce that, after all, I did know what real work is like. The day I met the contractor, a Princeton graduate, it turned out, he asked me whether I had done any physical labor before. In high school, during the summer, I lied. And although he seemed to regard me with skepticism, he decided to give me a try. Several days later, expectant, I arrived at my first construction site. I would take off my shirt to the sun, and at last grasp desired sensation. No longer afraid. At last become like a bracero. "We need those tree stumps out of here by tomorrow," the contractor said. I started to work. I labored with excitement that first morning, and all the days after. The work was harder than I could have expected, but it was never as tedious as my friends had warned me it would be. There was too much physical pleasure in the labor. Especially early in the day, I would be most alert to the sensations of movement and straining. Beginning around 7 each morning, when the air was still damp but the scent of weeds and dry earth anticipated the heat of the sun, I would feel my body resist the first thrusts of the shovel. My arms, tightened by sleep, would gradually loosen. After only several minutes, sweat would gather in beads on my forehead. And then, a short while later, I would feel my chest silky with sweat in the breeze. I would return to my work. A nervous spark of pain would fly up my arm and settle to burn like an ember in the thick of my shoulder. An hour, two passed. Three. My whole body would assume regular movements. My shoveling would be described by identical, even movements. Even later in the day, my enthusiasm for primitive sensation would survive the heat and the dust and the insects pricking my back. I would strain wildly for sensation as the day came to a close. At 3:30, quitting time, I would stand upright and slowly let my head fall back, luxuriating in the feeling of tightness relieved. Some of the men working nearby would watch me and laugh. Two or three of the older men took the trouble to teach me the right way to use a pick, the correct way to shovel. "You're doing it wrong, too fucking hard," one man scolded, then proceeded to show me. What persons who work with their bodies all their lives quickly learn the most economical way to use one's body in labor.
Don't make your back do so much work, he instructed.
I stood impatiently listening, half-listening, vaguely watching, then noticed his work-thickened fingers clutching the shovel. I was annoyed. I wanted to tell him that I enjoyed shoveling the wrong way. And I didn't want to learn the right way. I wasn't afraid of back pain. I liked the way my body felt sore at the end of the day. I was about to, but as it turned out, I didn't say a thing. Rather, it was at that moment I realized that I was fooling myself if I expected a few weeks of labor to gain me admission to the world of the laborer. I would not learn in 3 months what my father had meant by real work. I was not bound to this job. I could imagine its rapid conclusion. For me, the sensations of exertion and fatigue could be savored. For my father or uncle, working at comparable jobs when they were my age, such sensations were to be feared. Fatigue took a different toll on their bodies and minds. It was, I know, a simple insight. But it was with this realization that I took my first step that summer toward realizing something even more important about the worker. In the company of carpenters, electricians, plumbers, and painters at lunch, I would often sit quietly observant. I was not shy in such company. I felt easy, pleased by the knowledge that I was casually accepted, my presence taken for granted by men, exotics, who worked with their hands. Some days the younger men would talk and talk about sex, and they would howl at women who drove by in cars. Other days the talk at lunchtime was subdued. Men gathered in separate groups. It depended on who was around. There were rough, good-natured workers. Others were quiet. The more I remember that summer, the more I realize that there was no single type of worker. I am embarrassed to say I had not expected such diversity. I certainly had not expected to meet, for example, a plumber who was an abstract painter in his off hours and admired the work of Mark Rothko. Nor did I expect to meet so many workers with college diplomas. They were the ones who were not surprised that I intended to enter graduate school in the fall. I suppose what I really want to say here is painfully obvious, but I must say it nevertheless. The men of that summer were middle-class Americans. They certainly didn't constitute an oppressed society. Carefully completing their worksheets, talking about the fortunes of local football teams, planning Las Vegas vacations, comparing the gas mileage of various makes of campers, they were not los pobres my mother had spoken about. On two occasions, the contractor hired a group of Mexican aliens. They were employed to cut down some trees and haul off debris. In all, there were 6 men of varying age, the youngest in his late 20s, the oldest his father, perhaps 60 years old. They came and they left in a single old truck. Anonymous men. They were never introduced to the other men at the site. Immediately upon their arrival, they would follow the contractor's directions, start working, rarely resting, seemingly driven by a fatalistic sense that work which had to be done was best done as quickly as possible. I watched them sometimes. Perhaps they watched me. The only time I saw them pay me much notice was one day at lunchtime when I was laughing with the other men. The Mexicans sat apart when they ate, just as they worked by themselves. Quiet, I rarely heard them say much to each other. All I could hear were their voices calling out sharply to one another, giving directions. Otherwise, when they stood briefly resting, they talked among themselves in voices too hard to overhear. The contractor knew enough Spanish, and the Mexicans, or at least the oldest of them, their spokesman, seemed to know enough English to communicate. But because I was around, the contractor decided one day to make me his translator. He assumed I could speak Spanish. I did what I was told. Shyly, I went over to tell the Mexicans that the patron wanted them to do something else before they left for the day. As I started to speak, I was afraid with my old fear that I would be unable to pronounce the Spanish words. But it was a simple instruction I had to convey. I could say it in phrases. The dark, sweating faces turned toward me as I spoke. They stopped their work to hear me. Each nodded in response. I stood there. I wanted to say something more. But what could I say in Spanish, even if I could have pronounced the words right? Perhaps I just wanted to engage them in small talk, to be assured of their confidence, our familiarity. I thought for a moment to ask them where in Mexico they were from, something like that. And maybe I wanted to tell them, a lie if need be, that my parents were from the same part of Mexico. I stood there. Their faces watched me. The eyes of the man directly in front of me moved slowly over my shoulder, and I turned to follow his glance toward El Patron some distance away. For a moment, I felt swept up by that glance into the Mexican's company. But then I heard one of them returning to work, and then the others went back to work. I left them without saying anything more. When they had finished, the contractor went over to pay them in cash. He later told me that he paid them collectively for the job, though he wouldn't tell me their wages. He said something quickly about the good rate of exchange in their own country. I can still hear the loudly confident voice he used with the Mexicans. It was the sound of the gringo I had heard as a very young boy. And I can still hear the quiet, indistinct sounds of the Mexican, the oldest, who replied. At hearing that voice, I was sad for the Mexicans, depressed by their vulnerability, angry at myself. The adventure of the summer seemed suddenly ludicrous. I would not shorten the distance I felt from Los Pobres with a few weeks of physical labor. I would not become like them. They were different from me. After that summer, a great deal, and not very much really, changed in my life. The curse of physical shame was broken by the sun. I was no longer ashamed of my body. No longer would I deny myself the pleasing sensations of my maleness. During those years when middle-class black Americans began to assert with pride, "Black is beautiful," I was able to regard my complexion without shame. I am today darker than I ever was as a boy. I have taken up the middle-class sport of long-distance running. Nearly every day now I run 10 or 15 miles, barely clothed, my skin exposed to the California winter rain and wind or the summer sun of late afternoon. The torso, the soccer player's calves and thighs, the arms of the 20-year-old I never was, I possess now in my 30s. I study the youthful parody shape in the mirror, the stomach lipped tight by muscle, the shoulders rounded by chin-ups, the arms veined strong. This man, a man, I meet him. He laughs to see me, what I have become. The dandy. I wear double-breasted Italian suits and custom-made English shoes. I resemble no one so much as my father, the man pictured in those honeymoon photos. At that point in life when he abandoned the dandy's posture, I assume it. At the point when my parents would not consider going on vacation, I register at the Hotel Carlyle in New York and the Plaza Athénée in Paris. I am as taken by the symbols of leisure and wealth as they were. For my parents, however, those symbols became taunts, reminders of all they could not achieve in one lifetime. For me, those same symbols are reassuring reminders of public success. I tempt vulgarity to be reassured. I am filled with the gaudy delight, the monstrous grace of the nouveau riche. In recent years, I have had occasion to lecture in ghetto high schools. There I see students of remarkable style and physical grace. One can see more dandies in such schools than one ever will find in middle-class high schools. There is not the look of casual assurance I saw students at Stanford display. Ghetto girls mimic high-fashion models. Their dresses are a bold, forceful color, their figures elegant, long, the stance theatrical. Boys wear shirts that grip at their overdeveloped muscular bodies. Against a powerless future, they engage images of strength. Bad nutrition does not yet tell. Great disappointment, fatal to youth, awaits them still. For the moment, movements in school hallways are dance-like, a procession of postures in a sexual mask. Watching them, I feel a kind of envy. I wonder how different my adolescence would have been had I been free. But no, it is my parents I see. Their optimism during those years when they were entertained by Italian grand opera. The registration clerk in London wonders if I have been to Switzerland, and the man who carries my luggage in New York guesses the Caribbean. My complexion becomes a mark of my leisure, yet no one would regard my complexion the same way if I entered such hotels through the service entrance. That is only to say that my complexion assumes its significance from the context of my life. My skin in itself means nothing. I stress the point because I know there are people who would label me disadvantaged because of my color. They make the same mistake I made as a boy when I thought a disadvantaged life was circumscribed by particular occupations. That summer I worked in the sun may have made me physically indistinguishable from the Mexicans working nearby. My skin was actually darker because, unlike them, I worked without wearing a shirt. By late August, my hands were probably as tough as theirs. But I was not one of los pobres. What made me different from them was an attitude of mind, my imagination of myself. I do not blame my mother for warning me away from the sun when I was young. In a world where her brother had become an old man in his 20s because he was dark, my complexion was something to worry about. "Don't run in the sun," she warns me today. I run. In the end, my father was right, though perhaps he did not know how right or why, to say that I would never know what real work is. I will never know what he felt at his last factory job. If tomorrow I worked at some kind of factory, it would go differently for me. My long education would favor me. I could act as a public person, able to defend my interests, to unionize, to petition, to speak up, to challenge and demand. I will never know what real work is. I will never know what the Mexicans knew, gathering their shovels and ladders and saws. Their silence stays with me now. The wages those Mexicans received for their labor were only a measure of their disadvantaged condition. Their silence is more telling. They lack a public identity. They remain profoundly alien, persons apart, people lacking a union, obviously, people without grounds. They depend upon the relative